We're just slowly flying the plane into the mountain right now.
Oh no, there's no mountain. There's no plane. We're just in the puddle of shit on the ground, but it's okay.
I'm Alex Higley.
And I'm Lindsay Hunter. And I'm a writer. Bud. Welcome to I'm a Writer, But. Today we have Andrew Lipstein, who is a writer based in Brooklyn. His debut novel, Last Resort, is out now from Farrar, Straus & Giroux in the US and Wedenfield & Nicholson in the UK. His second novel, The Vegan, will be published in July 2023, also by FSG and WNN. Welcome, Andrew.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Do people say Giroux or Giroux?
Farrar, Straus & Giroux. I say Giroux myself.
I think that's what I said. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know if that's right.
We're making it right. As a former FSG.
I was going to say, Lindsay, come on.
I know.
Didn't you take the test when they put out your books?
I'm so pathetic because I remember talking to someone and they were reading some book that I wanted a copy of. And they were like, oh, but it's on Macmillan. So you could easily get a copy. And I was like, what are you talking about? I didn't even know.
I did not know that until you just said it.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, but yeah. All right. Well, I feel better. Andrew, will you please read to us?
Happily. So this is from the first few pages of Last Resort. Caleb, it's brilliant, he said, not listening. Brilliant. He was looking past my ear to the bar, where I assumed our server must be, or some other woman. That our waitress wasn't conventionally attractive didn't stop him from making a face at me after she'd introduced herself and walked away. I had mirrored it, raising my eyebrows and sucking in my lips before taking a sip of water to break the moment. His eyes came back to me. He clasped his hands, placed them on the table, and began talking. I could hardly listen. I couldn't stop thinking of the affectations infecting his words. Do get in touch. Have a go. If I could be so daring. Unearned pauses, overemphasized mm-hmms, and how rampant it is in the book world and elsewhere. Like the cafe by my apartment, stocked with people who dress like artists on weekends but spend their weekdays on Slack. He ended his brief soliloquy with something about Mavis Gallant, whom I never read and whose name I thought was pronounced differently. I looked it up when I got home. He was right. This was all in response to a new story idea, which was a response to him asking me if I had my next book in mind. Next book, as if the one we were meeting to discuss were already in the past. Which is supposed to be a seg from our aimless banter to real business talk. When I told him the new story idea, a party of 30-somethings where everyone slowly realizes death is present, literally in the room, in disguise, and by the end of the night it will take one of them, so that the entire time they all have to prove how full of life they are, he said, a word or two before I finished, love it, which made me hate it and regret ever having dreamt it up. Ah, Gallant, I said. He looked at his hand, rubbed his pointer and middle fingers together, then scanned the room. He said he wished we could smoke in restaurants, and then, thanks, Giuliani, which I thought was an ironic riff on, thanks, Obama, which is already ironic. Also, the smoking ban was Bloomberg, not Giuliani, but he was apparently sincere. This tarnished some of my assumptions about him, mainly that he should be unflaggingly smooth. Ellis Buford was a quote-unquote big shot agent, a phrase I'd heard from too many people with too little irony. He was taller than I'd expected, but less handsome in some inscrutable way. I disliked him the second we shook hands, when he apologized for being late. Please forgive my truancy, he'd said. But all of that didn't matter. Nothing mattered in the face of the fact that he was a big shot agent who was going to change my life. Yes, the phrase is ridiculous, but the concept transcends ridiculousness, the concept being power. Big shot. Those two words were the first my lips formed, the second we hung up, after he called me out of the blue, on the Saturday morning, 4 days before our lunch. I was lying on my couch, drinking coffee, listening to John Wizards at full blast, my roommate was out of town, and playing chess online with my computer on my stomach, a ritual I don't normally interrupt before it fulfills its purpose, a bowel movement, when my eyes wandered to the window, catching sight of a building in the distance. I recognized it and was taken aback. The building was in Brooklyn Heights, meaning that my window didn't look south but west. That I'd been mistaken about the cardinal orientation of my apartment for the year I'd lived there was unbelievable. I was someone who could point north any time of day. I considered finishing the game, but I was going to lose anyway. So I put on my slippers and walked downstairs and around the apartment until I found my fire escape. I turned around and found the building again. I was right, I realized. I'd been wrong that whole time. And that's when my phone rang. "Caleb," he said. "Yes," I said. "This is Ellis Buford. I've just finished your novel. Do you have time?"
Andrew, I was curious. I feel like there's so many different superstitions around writing about writing. And in a first novel, you just tackle it head on. I was wondering if you had any trepidation going in, having the kind of the heart of your novel be about writing itself.
I would say I didn't. Where I was coming from when I started to write this was I had already tried and failed to write, I don't know, somewhere between 4 and 6 other novels, which were so far from my lived experience. And I felt had failed for that very purpose, that when I started this, I kind of consciously was choosing to do something I hadn't done before. And maybe perhaps having that all that failure under my belt already, it kind of preempted any fear I might have felt otherwise.
When you say that you tried and failed, is it that you wrote them, you liked them, and you sent them out and there was no like response, or you wrote them and you hated them?
The first. Okay. I mean, I had gotten an agent for a couple of them. And the agent couldn't sell them. So I had been getting closer and closer. And then, you know, when you get an agent, you sort of feel like you will get the book sold. And that was not the case for 2 or 3 times for me.
Oh, God. Yeah, Alex and I have learned that.
It's not something I wish on anyone, truly.
No. Me either.
When I think of other people going through it, I can't help but just, my heart drops.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because you feel like you're in the safe arms of your loving daddy, you know, and he's not going to let you fall off the swing. Mm-hmm. And you're just like pumping your legs higher and higher, you know, you're
ready
just
to
like,
go. Yeah.
Yeah. And then daddy's like,
we're slowing down.
Daddy has a shotgun and he is absolutely whipping you in the face with the butt end of it.
That would be easier.
Alex is still processing, if you can't tell. So was that agent different than the one that that you sold Last Resort with?
Well, so the funny thing is I actually sold Last Resort without an agent. Mm-hmm. I had gotten an agent who I actually really loved, and she brought it to a great point editorially, and she couldn't sell it. And I asked her if I could sell it myself, you know, being just completely desperate. And I sent it to a few editors under a pseudonym. And I technically sold FSG the World Rights, but I had gotten my UK editor myself as well.
What?
That is insane.
What was your pseudonym?
The pseudonym was Caleb Horowitz, the protagonist of the book.
Oh, come on.
Oh, wow. So were they like, is this you? Or like, was that kind of what was freaking them out?
You know, the book is about publishing, obviously. And when you use a pseudonym, I think, you know, it ignites people's imagination and they wonder who this person is, which is sort of why I thought it would work, because they would think I was somebody, which I'm not. You know, they would think I was like someone that they might even know, but was using a pseudonym.
And so how did they know it was a pseudonym? Did you say?
I said it was a pseudonym. Yeah. I mean,
you're a genius.
Once I started reading, but my first conversation with my US editor was, he said the first thing, you know, do I know you? And when I first spoke to my UK editor, he needed to make sure I wasn't like a particular person who he almost suspected I was, who's like a persona non grata before he continued the conversations.
Did he tell you who it was?
He did, but I just have a feeling I shouldn't say.
Okay. Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Alex Higley.
It was Alex Higley.
Yeah, I'm sure they hate grocers.
The guy's known for being wrong in every way, and
he's such an asshole.
I really love that you read the part that you read, because I can remember having similar lunches and feeling like, this is it. Like, I'm going to be, you know, a name now, you know, like I'm going to be having like all these lunches all the time. Like it's going to, I'm going to be living in the Greenwich Village somehow, even though I live in Chicago. And also,
right, it's gonna. I mean, it's because it's part of the fantasy, right? You already feel the lunch. You already feel like you are. It's a piece of success already with that lunch.
Yes, it's like this is what I imagined when I thought I'm gonna be. If I thought I'm gonna be a successful writer, it was having this lunch with someone important.
Exactly, and, in a sort of fancy place, which is, you know, a little bit pretentious, but you're like, this fits the image, so I like it.
This is just what people do when they're successful, right? Like they don't go to Olive Garden to celebrate their successes like I do, you know? But the other thing about that part is, and throughout the book, there's so many funny, really funny, like I laughed aloud, L-A-L, quite often, but they're also so cringy and so sometimes like almost you're peeking out from your fingers as you read. Because we are given all of Caleb. We are given, well, all of the Caleb that he knows. We are so close to him, and it naturally creates a tension, you know, like this sort of closeness. It's not a claustrophobia, but it's like a tight space. We feel comfortable that we're in his head and that he's given us the goods, you know, because he is quite honest about things. Like at one point he says he could fart, you know, like as he's leaving, he wants to like fart as he leaves. It's like a fuck you to some people. And I wanted to know, because I feel like that's crucial to the way that the novel plays out. And it's crucial to the way that the plot is believable. So in that, was he always that close when you were writing him? Was it always this first person extremely close in his head? Or was it different when you first started writing it?
No, it was definitely that way from the beginning. The idea being that, you know, if I could really be a first person experience for me, where I almost felt like I was acting and him, then I could even have his flaws kind of appear in a more natural way than like, I'm going to write this in here, you know? Mm-hmm. So that was there from the very start for sure.
Do you welcome people talking to you about autofiction, or are you like, please leave me alone?
I've had a lot of people who know me talk about the book as if Caleb was me, as far as,
oh, wild.
As far as say, asking if the book was autofiction. I mean, I think it's so obviously not autofiction in like structurally, because
yeah,
it's so driven by plot and
exactly. You know,
yeah.
That's, I mean, that was the thing I truly loved about the book, was it's like, it's so well plotted, and it felt in a way like a throwback to me. I was like, this reminds me of some of the, I don't know. It reminded me of some of the first person voices that I like really fell in love with, like a powerful, well plotted first person novel is a favorite thing of mine. I thought of like The Sports Writer, which is a unique example, I guess, but I don't know.
The Sports Writer, not by Frederick, no.
Ford, Richard Ford.
Oh, Richard Ford. Wait, is that one that takes place over July 4th? No, that's Independence Day.
Yeah, it's the next one. But it's exactly, I mean, it's the same. That's in the sequel to Sports Writer for sure.
I mean, I read Independence Day, and I just remember it making me like more sad than any book I've ever read.
Oh my God, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. I never read the third book in the trilogy, but I love the first two. Anyway, yeah, was that heavily plotted approach present in the previous attempts with the novel, Andrew, or was that something that you had much more in mind with Last Resort?
Yeah, definitely was not there as much. And it's funny. I mean, I think the answer is definitely yes. It was more in mind with Last Resort. I don't think I ever consciously had that thought. But, you know, every time you fail and fall on your face in such a huge way like that, and in a way that's incredibly emotionally painful, you do, inevitably learn a lot of lessons from that. And I remember, you know, having a few conversations with an agent for a previous manuscript just about the term stakes. Like, she was kind of obsessed with the term stakes. And I think a younger, you know, more ego-driven me was like unable to concede that you would need to think of a novel in that way in order to make the plot work. And I didn't really think about Last Resort in that way so much, but the agent who took it on and didn't end up selling it, she had us redo a lot of the second part. There's three parts of this, in a way so that the arc was more natural. And I think through that process, I did learn a lot and made this book more plotted in that way. And while I'm now writing my third book now, my second's coming out next year. I wrote those from the very beginning, maybe a lot more with an arc in mind. Mm. Mm.
I was so impressed and excited by how you kept upping the ante in the book with the plot. Like, I thought the tension with whether or not Ellis would ever find out would last a lot longer. Like, I thought it would be like one of the main sources of tension as I read the book. And then he just comes out and tells him.
That,
and it happens again and again and again, where you're like, oh man, that's big news. I, you know, he's probably going to keep this to himself. And then he just tells people, or he just does it. I thought that was so admirable, like as writer to writer. I was so impressed by that, because it makes things harder for you, but it also makes things more interesting as you're writing, right?
100%. That was definitely on my mind. So when I do obviously write very plotted books, and I'll continue to do so, I don't really have a proper outline to begin with. I basically have now in this book and the next two, like, always started with a big plot point that I feel like will come at the end of the novel. Your instinct is like 100% spot on. And then I basically have a conversation with myself, like, you know, if I'm just building up to something that I know is going to happen, I'm going to get bored with it. And the book can't possibly be interesting to a reader if I'm already bored with it. Mm-hmm. So let's just crunch this. Let's put pressure on this and move it earlier, and, you know, have everything that comes before, you know, I'm not, there's no fat in it. I'm not wasting anything. And then from there, as you say, like, I'll put myself up to the challenge and see if I can't come up with something better. And then that happens like two or three or four more times. And the result is that I'm super interested in the book. And I think that comes through more to the reader if I feel like I'm not just biding my time until I hit some plot point.
I think ultimately too, it's easier to draft that way, because there's a way where you can delude yourself into thinking you're a genius if you're building up to one big reveal or one big insight. And instead, it's just like, nope, this is what I got. Let's put the cards on the table, onto the next, keep going. And it makes the process, like you're saying, you're walking with the reader alongside you, as opposed to, you know, smoke and mirrors. And I think that it actually ends up making writing a novel easier. Ultimately, I think of this, I do a similar thing, but I think of it as digging a hole. I just think of like, all right, let's just keep digging this hole, because gotta eventually climb out, I guess. Let's make it a fun climb up.
Yeah, let's make it as deep. Yeah, you never want to stop digging and say, I'm just gonna, whenever there's not motion or whenever you're biding your time.
Exactly.
You know, a novel always has to be moving, whether it's through character or an exchange of information or, you know, displacement or something. And if you're just in a holding pattern, I don't think that ever works.
Exactly.
It reminds me of, Alex, did Stuart Dybeck say this to you, that have your character want something?
No, it was
a glass of water.
Yeah, right. No. Patrick Somerville said one time. Oh, I don't know. He might have said that. I always say this thing Patrick Somerville said, where he said, if you don't know how to write a novel, have one character go after one thing.
Yeah.
And there you go. And it's actually the best advice I ever have gotten about writing novels. I feel like it's a great way to get into it if you're struggling and don't really know how to keep that motion persistent, as you were saying, Andrew.
Vonnegut also said every character should want something, even if it is only a glass of water.
Oh, that's great. I actually didn't know that line.
Was there anything in the pacing or in the plotting where you took a turn with the narrative and realized it was the wrong turn?
Well, sort of. So we had actually found an editor who wanted an exclusive submission, we being the agent I'd worked with, and he basically wanted the entire ending rewritten. And it was unexpected. I, of course, did it because it was my only option at the time. And all while I was doing it, just feeling terrible because I thought I was doing all this work for one person who might just, you know, not like the book. And he ended up basically ghosting us, which, you know, but the new ending is the ending as it exists today. And I think it is, you know, so much greater than what it was. But that was basically the only time that I have probably ever really structurally rewritten a book.
The original ending?
The original ending was that Caleb, I don't know if I can reveal this without spoiling the rest of the book.
Okay, everyone, a spoiler is ahead. So, you know, fast forward.
So the Caleb basically hunts down Sophia, and she ends up being a nurse who basically just tells him that Avi is writing his own book about his experience. And at that point, Caleb was trying to find salvation and writing a book about what had happened to him, and basically finds out that he's scooped. And I think it was a little bit pathetic and a little bit anticlimactic, and it didn't stick the landing, and it wasn't nearly as cringeworthy or interesting or putting Caleb to the test as the current ending does.
I love the current ending. More spoilers. There's a 1-2 punch. He gets one from Sandra and he gets one from Sophia. Annabelle's her real name, right? Cassandra says you're only happy when you want something, or like you always have to want or desire something. And he's like, you're right. And then but then later at the very end, when Sophia's like, I'm not on the plane, and the reason that you are has nothing to do with me. It's so earned at that point. And it's one of the few times where you can see him clearly outside of himself, you know, cause like, even when I'm cringing, even when I'm like, oh no, I'm with him. I at least on a human level, I understand why he's making the decisions that he's making. And those two moments are when it really offered such an important glimpse of him that really rounds all of it out. And it just kind of, and then to couple that with the last line about how he can't imagine where he's going. It's so beautiful and so gasp worthy.
How did you approach actually drafting Last Resort from, what was the initial impetus? Was the Avi story the one that kind of got you in and you felt like you could weave in a bit of your own life into that and kind of combine the two and see what happens? Or what was like the initial spark?
Yeah, the initial spark or plot point or conflict was how the first part ends, where these two sort of former acquaintances, writers, need to come to a compromise that is like at once both completely unnatural but perfectly fits what happened. I talking about before, I thought that was going to come way later in the book, and I thought I was going to be building towards that, but that was like the beginning of it, that this writer is finally finding success and basically needs to basically reach this tremendous compromise in order to keep what he thought was already in the bank.
Have either of you had just heard secondhand or maybe experienced firsthand from other writers, like stories where people were like calling dibs on anecdotes that are being told or anything like that, or have seen situations like that go bad in real life?
Well, I actually was inspired by something that's very vaguely similar that happened to me, that happened in the book, where I had basically sent an earlier manuscript that was the Last Resort in Last Resort, to an agent, and the agent had a reader who was a former, I don't know, friend, acquaintance of mine. And he thought it was similar to his life.
Oh my God.
Whoa.
And it was, it wasn't like what happens in Last Resort is plagiarism. He never wrote anything. It was more like, a fact or two from his life. And we had like a series of conversations about it. And he sort of at once like admitted the character wasn't him, but also sort of like, I sensed that he wanted it to be sort of in the way that I later give to like the character of Joe.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, it was that tension of like this desire to sort of be almost like put into fiction that I found interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's really scary too. It's really, I feel like there's something just so that just creeps me out about that instinct in a person that wants to be in fiction. I don't know, maybe it's because I know so many fucking writers, but
well, yeah,
it feels like a tribute, right? Like, oh, I'm so interesting that this person had to write me, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like all of our, you know, subconscious dreams about art is that our life is worthy of it. I mean, whenever, like, I think whenever you're looking at a painting and you really allow yourself to feel it, you are, you know, dissolving the part of your brain that's saying, but this isn't reality. You're just letting yourself believe it for a moment. And whenever you read a book too and allow yourself to get into it, or of course write one, you really have to delude yourself into thinking that there is no line between art and life, because life is never good enough for art. And I think there is a drive for people to be put into art and want that to be the case. And that comes from that they want to exist in art. That would be, if you're an art lover, if you have had an art experience where you feel moved, that is like a sublime dream, I think. And the going narrative today, and you know, since I wrote this, there are a lot of stories like the Bad Art Friend story and the Kristen Rapanian story, where the person whose life gets taken is also a writer and feels like they are wronged in a significant way in the way of plagiarism. And they don't like having their story taken. But if you look at the history of art, I mean, you have basically one of the greatest privileges of being in the aristocracy, you know, in the past 1,000 years, is that you could commission some of the greatest artists to take your likeness and turn your likeness into art and add that special touch to elevate your life out of the realm of life into art. So I don't think it's anything new or weird. I think it's incredibly natural and has to have existed for as long as art has.
Definitely. Yeah. I just say, I guess when I think about some of the limitations of the people who are making the art and being accused of stealing a likeness, it's just, it's so funny that it's disgusting to me. That's all I mean. But yes, of course, of course.
No, I mean, yeah, and there's also shitty art too, right? It's my friend who's a shitty short story writer like made me the dumbass character in a short story and it sucked.
There you go.
That doesn't feel as nice as being an aristocracy and having, you know.
No.
My friend in high school was a really great artist. And she one day was like, she always would draw our friends, and she drew me one day, and I was so excited because her drawings were beautiful. And when she was done, she handed it to me, and I had these like deep eye bags. And I was like, wait, no.
Yeah.
No, like that. I don't
burn that. That.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I think I have it somewhere just to remind myself, keep myself humble.
Oh man.
Did Caleb ever feel far from you or like hard to grasp? And if so, how did you pull him back?
Yeah, I think when he had to make some of the most, you know, consequential decisions in the book, those felt like, I mean, whenever you're having a character make a decision for a preordained plot point, mm-hmm. you really have to, I think, approach that intuitively, because if it goes wrong, it can feel really contrived and forced and unearned.
Like you're moving his arms for him.
Exactly. And
stop hitting yourself.
Exactly. The justification isn't there, and the reader will think this, the character is just, you know, a mannequin. But yeah, when he makes some of those decisions towards the end, he, spoiler alert, kisses somebody else while he's reuniting with his ex-girlfriend. And, you know, scenes like that were hard for me to write because I didn't feel like I knew him as well as I had thought, maybe because there was a greater distance between him and myself, or maybe just because I was giving him traits that I found more disgusting than, or not disgusting is a strong word, but more negative than interesting. But yeah, I feel that a lot.
But that's so interesting what you said, that those decisions, you felt like you didn't know him, mm-hmm. but you still, it's such a cognitive dissonance, even though in the moment it might not have felt that way, but like you're writing him, you know him better than anyone, but those moments you felt like very far away from him, but they were still happening and they were still true.
Yeah. I think that there's certain, and this, you know, when I talked about acting and like feeling like I was him, the best case scenario in that is that you're generating perspectives or actions that are unexplained, but feel real. Mm-hmm. And I think it's okay if you feel far away from a character who you're obviously making decisions for, as long as you and the reader feel like there is real, even if opaque, real justification and decisions underneath that. As opposed to an action only satisfying a plot necessity.
Doesn't it feel like that's the moment when not to be corny, but like when the magic is happening? It's like, that's when, you know, all of us at one point have said like, you know, I just followed it where it was going, you know, I just watched it happen and I wrote it down, you know, and I know that that's silly, but like, that seems like one of those moments where you had constructed such a, I was going to say structure, but I had said constructed. So that feels too close. You know, you had made such a real scaffolding, such a real life, that even though he was doing something that felt like far away from you or far away from your knowledge of him, it was still happening, which to me feels like that's what you want as a writer, right?
Yeah, I think, well, I think that specifically comes down to character building, that when somebody, when you can, you're basically in the flow, you know, what you said is both a cliche and true, I think, when you're just sort of not having to consciously make decisions, but you are at the same time, that comes down to have specificity of character, because any, you know, everyone in the world does everything in the world. Specific people cannot do everything in the world. Specific people can only do what they're going to do. And when you build character in just such a specific way, and you know that character in the way that the reader knows them too, they'll just sort of tell you what is natural and what makes sense for them.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering if any of the agents that you ended up sending Last Resort to thought that they were, I'm blanking out. Yeah, if they were Alice, if they were like, is this me? I mean, did you get any kind of publisher insider feedback from some of that?
I got some feedback from editors who said, a couple editors who said, I think I know who this is. And it's not one person, obviously, but it is a few people, and maybe a few of them saw the manuscript, but they didn't, perhaps they're like Alice smooth enough they wouldn't let on.
That's so great.
No, my wife her first language is Danish.
Oh wow.
And I found that I speak and think in some of the ways that she speaks, which I wouldn't say is more precise, but it is specific to how you would just translate Danish to English.
Oh, how interesting.
I'm glad that you brought her up, because in your acknowledgments, you thank her for her criticism and ideas. Is she one of your first readers when you're writing?
I mean, she's basically one of two readers.
Oh, wow.
And she, I've actually never really had anyone in my life who I have spoken to about books as I'm writing them, and even relied on them to help me make decisions, as I did with her for every book I've written since we've met.
Wow.
But she, she's a journalist, and she is a wonderful, has a great eye for storytelling. And I just really trust her opinion. Like when we, you know, when we see a movie, I'm like hesitant to say what I think, because I think she'll maybe have a better opinion.
You're like, tell what me high what praise. I'm supposed to think.
I mean, that's, I feel like that's the highest praise though. That's, you know, that's amazing.
Whenever we watch a movie, we, on the count of three, give it a rating from 0 to 10. And we saw a movie yesterday and she gave it a 9, and I was just floored because I did not think it was a 9, but that really made me think.
What movie was it?
It was a movie called Official Competition that is in theaters now with Penelope Cruz, and it's a Spanish movie about
Is it the Almodovar?
Almodovar, yeah.
No, I don't think so.
Oh.
No, it's not Parallel Mothers.
Oh, that's what I was thinking of. Yep.
It has the same, it's totally the same as The Square. It's sort of funny and outside.
I love The Square.
I like The Square a lot more, but it's definitely in the same family of, it's the tone and the sense of humor.
Oh my God, I'm so out of it. I'm looking at it right now and I haven't even heard of this movie.
Andrew, is it on Hulu?
I know nothing about it.
No, we saw it in theaters. So,
oh, okay.
And I think it's just in theaters.
Okay. I only watch things that are on Hulu.
That's, you fucking talk about Hulu more than,
are they a sponsor here? What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. We're willing to take anyone's money pretty much. So,
no, I just discovered that they seem to have the best streaming, like horror. There's some real stinkers on there, but like the best horror that the stuff I really like is always on Hulu, you know?
There you go.
So when it comes on Hulu, I'll watch it.
I don't know why that's so funny to me. I'm sorry.
Who are your favorite authors, and are any of them or any of any books that you were thinking about or works of art as you wrote Last Resort?
I don't even think I can answer the author question, because I have, whenever I do, I always regret it because it never feels quite right. But there was actually a specific book or series that directly inspired Last Resort, and that was the Patrick Melrose novels by Edward St. Aubin. It's I read it basically like in the months preceding starting Last Resort. And cool. It's just, I mean, the sense of humor and like just sort of the way that he doesn't care if you think he's funny, I just love so much.
When I asked you about your favorite authors, who immediately came to mind? I know you don't want to answer the question and I won't hold you to it, but can you tell me?
So, I mean, in the past, I've just said Rachel Cusk and Ben Lerner because I really like them, but I feel like that answer is probably the most popular answer.
No, I think that's a brave answer because they're both like so actively still working. I think I love that answer because I think people never say that.
And it also makes such sense when I think about your book.
Yeah, absolutely.
And most people answer like dead authors.
Yeah, people will say, you know, I don't know, Kafka or something.
Kafka. Ugh.
Oh my God. I feel like if someone answered that question, Kafka and Shakespeare, I think that's the most embarrassing combination. You know, it's like this person maybe attended like third grade.
That's like when they asked Trump like what his favorite testament was, and he's like, both of them. They're all good. Yeah. I like them both. They're my favorite.
Both of them. Jesus Christ. Lindsay, what do you say when people ask you that? You were going so hard at Andrew. Let's make you answer it.
Yeah, that's a good point, Alex. Thank you.
Yeah, you're no problem.
Me too, by the way.
Yeah, of course.
Am I being interviewed?
Yeah, you are.
My podcast.
I know.
My podcast and yours.
Yeah, kind of.
Okay, great question. Yeah, what is that about? Why suddenly can I not think of a single author?
It's kind of tough, isn't it?
It's tough.
Name the best, because then it's like really that person's better than everyone else you've read. Like that's peak.
I know. I'm trying to think of like who could write a book that I'd be like, oh my. Okay, well I went through a huge Claire Fuller.
You situation. Love Claire Fuller. Yes, you do.
I just could not get enough of her. But I don't. I mean, I love her, but I wouldn't. I don't know who's my favorite.
I don't think of you as talking about
who only wrote one of those books.
You write Unsettled Ground.
Yes, that's Claire Fuller. Yeah.
She blurred my book, actually.
No way. What? I swear to God, you got some blurbs, my friend. You got some bangers on here.
For the UK edition?
Yeah, my UK editor got her.
Oh my gosh, I absolutely love her. You lucky duck. Do you think you're going to go over there for any events?
Not for a last resort. When the book came out, I was also in Denmark. Well, I was in New York for the month it came out, but when it came out in the UK, I was in Denmark.
Okay. Do you guys live there part of the year?
No, we don't, but we go there often.
Okay.
Yeah.
So your next book is The Vegan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's I
love that title.
I know that title is so provocative.
That wasn't the first title. Both books had a previous title before. And the previous title for The Vegan, which I really loved up until I hated it, was Flash and Yearn.
Wait, say that again?
Flash and Yearn. It's from a Berryman poem. It's sort of like the opposite of The Vegan in that it's like makes you think of like a fusty, dusty poetry collection as opposed to The Vegan, which sounds like obviously...
The Vegan. Funny. Holy shit.
Flash and Yearn makes me think about like someone on the dance floor. Like, you're sad, so you're dancing. You're flashing and yearning.
Oh.
But The Vegan is like, it pops.
It pops.
Yeah, I'm definitely for the Netflix adaptation with The Vegan.
Yes, yes. Was that sold along with Last Resort or...
No, I got an agent after Last Resort who sold The Vegan.
Okay.
And I sold that basically a little more than a year ago.
So, Andrew, Lindsay also sold, was it both, all three of your FSG books without an agent? Is that true?
Okay.
Really? I didn't know that.
Well, my first book was on a small press, so that was without an agent. And then...
Yeah, but...
My publisher told me you should be writing something because as soon as this book comes out, people are going to say, what else are you writing? What can you send us? We want. And I didn't believe him. So I didn't write anything. So then I started hearing from a bunch of people like FSG. And at the time, Cal Morgan was at Harper and someone from Random House and a couple like agents, and they were all like, what are you write? What else do you have? You know, I'd love to see whatever else you have. And I was like, cool. I'll let you know. So then I wrote some stuff. I had a new collection that I tried to send out on my own to some small presses, and I blogged about it. Just said like, I sent my new collection out and here's hoping. And Emily Bell at FSG was like, why didn't you send it to me? What's wrong with you? And because I didn't think they wanted a collection. So I was like, you can have it here. And so she loved it. And then she was like, but why don't we do a 2-book deal? Why don't you send me your novel? Because I had been lying that I had a novel and, you know, to keep her on the hook. And so I was like, oh, yeah. I'll send you my novel. Like when? Like in a couple of days. And she was like, that works. And I was like, okay, how about like, I don't know, like 10,000 words. And she's like, sure. That sounds good. And so over the weekend, I wrote 10,000 words of a novel and I sent it to her.
I have many questions for you.
Okay.
But what you just said made me think like I would be so terrified to send 10,000 words I'd just written without having the chance to look at them because I mean, you know, first drafts are famously terrible.
Okay. Speak for yourself. I know I was terrified and I was drinking so much coffee that like I took a break to go grocery shopping with my husband, like in the afternoon. And I was vibrating. Like I literally watched my own body vibrating. I was full of terror and fear, but I was really worried that, it was an opportunity that was going to pass me by because there had been so many conversations I'd had before that, where I was sort of like, yeah, I'll write a novel eventually. I was like working full time and doing this reading series. And I just didn't have time to be writing a novel. I mean, I actually did. Now that I have three kids, I realize how much time I had, but I felt like such a fool and an idiot and an asshole because it had been like 2 years since my first book came out, 2 years that people were like, send us something. So I was like, I have to do this. And Emily had been keeping in steady touch with me. And so I trusted her and I'm sure she knew. I'm positive she knew I was just whatever, you know, like I was just, she just needed something to sell. And it was early in her career too. We were kind of like holding each other up, I think.
When was this? I mean, she's great. Emily Bell is great. She's at that new imprint.
She's
now.
At Zando now. Yeah. So this was before I had kids. I think in 2012, maybe I signed the contract. It all went down. Even 2011.
Did you think to get an agent after you had gotten her?
Well, she was like, okay, so we're going to do this deal and you probably want an agent to help you through it. And I had this long conversation with Patrick Somerville, who is a friend, and was like, hey, you know, I like all this stuff's happening. And if you ever want to talk it through, and so like we had a long conversation about it. And his thought was, you should definitely do this deal with an agent, because if agents see that you do deals without them, then they might not want to work with you or something. That was his advice. And it was based on his own life experience. And so Emily said, you know, I have some people I'm thinking of that would be good for you. And some of them are friends, and, you know, I can set you up with, they're all interested in you. So just say the word and you can have calls with all of them. And, Jim, just like, he's very similar to my mentor that I had in grad school, Dan Beachy Quick, who's a poet. They speak the same, you know, like they're very thoughtful. And so I just liked him a lot. So I went with Jim and yeah, he's been my agent ever since.
Wow. Wait, so, but he represented you for that, for the first book, for the first two.
Yeah. I mean, it was a done deal, but he just like helped, I think he helped us secure, world rights. I think. He helped like they weren't going to offer me any more money or anything like that. And we weren't going to be able to go and tell like Harper, like, hey, FSG is, you know, cause that would have been shitty. But he helped me. Yeah. He helped me through the deal and then helped me sell my next book and then helped me sell this book that's coming out next year.
Yeah. That makes sense. And that is definitely definitely, I mean, I think that two out of three of us went that course is pretty unheard of.
It's weird, right?
I feel like the way all books get sold, though, I mean, that is something that comes up again and again when we talk to people, is like when you actually hear the whole story of how whatever it may be, whatever the book is, for the most part, comes to publication, it's like, holy shit, really? Like,
I know.
I feel like there's always a beat in there where it's just so improbable, the series of events. It's just unlikely that books are published. Despite there being too many.
Yeah, it's that odd thing. It's like everyone's getting published in a straightforward way except for the person you're talking to.
Yeah, exactly. Totally. Exactly. And when you were mentioning how you rewrote the ending and then the guy ghosted you, I can so relate to that. And I know lots of people can, because like I rewrote a whole novel in the hopes that this editor would be able to take it, you know, and that didn't even work out. And I think a lot of, like, we know as writers, it's all about like showing up, you know, because we know writers in our lives who don't anymore. It's not really what they want to do anymore. Their priorities have changed, or they just don't like it, or whatever, for whatever reason, they've stopped showing up. Maybe they will one day. And so to me, it's like, I just have to keep trying. I have to try this next thing, or I have to try this next thing.
Right. I agree with you completely. I when you were talking, when you said that happened to you too, I think there's also, and even the phrase showing up, I think implies or is a window into the natural power dynamics of the relationship, where the editor is at the top and then the agent and then the writer. And you're always feeling, when you're talking to the next person up or twice up, if you're talking directly to your editor, that they have all the power. And you know, I think it isn't uncommon that an editor asks for an exclusive and then ghosts.
Yeah.
I was told by my agent I shouldn't feel bad about it because it happens a lot. But that sort of points to like a larger system where, you know, people who have the power. I mean, it's miserable to spend however long it takes you, you know, 3 to 6 months, 3 months to 2 years, who knows, working on something, and then to have, you know, not even get a thoughtful email or something. It's like, it's at once like basic sort of human, just, I don't know, empathy, whatever. But then on the flip side, it's like, you know, show up, as you say, like make up for it as a writer, because the truth is that other people will do that.
Yep.
It sucks.
It's the only thing I really know how to do. I don't know how to make people buy my stuff. I don't know how to make, the only thing I know how to do is to do the work. And when I like narrow it down to that, it becomes so clear. And I, you know, I have to constantly ask myself, well, do I still want to do the work? And as long as the answer is yes, then I don't have a problem showing up. That and understanding like, okay, I'm not going to make Caleb money ever. Right. Like, well, I'm doing this for another reason.
You're writing literary fiction in the hopes of getting rich, you know?
Yeah. Right.
You're crazy. You're absolutely fucking crazy.
So my OnlyFans is.
That's honestly the next, we're not so far away from that.
No, I know. My husband and I talk about that all the time, because we're like, we could do like foot fetish stuff. That'd be fine. That's not bad. Like, my kids would be ashamed.
I've been hearing a lot about foot fetish stuff recently.
It's a thing. It's a real thing.
Like a foot wiki or something. Wiki foot. Oh, gosh. I just feel like in the past week I've heard just a ton.
Okay, drop your URL when you tweet about this episode so everyone can find your foot.
Drop those feet.
I assume drop that when you're feet. Having writers on, you would include their wiki foot.
We typically do. We didn't want to ask you to begin the interview. We were typically going to save it for the end.
We always so, warm yeah. up to that.
Yeah, well, we got to warm you up, and then we ask you for the wiki point. Feet.
For sure.
Oh, man.
Well, thank you so much. This has been really fun. I love your
thanks,
book.
Thanks, Andrew. This was fun.
Thanks so much for having me. This was a ton of fun.
Yeah. I just got back from North Carolina, as you know.
Mm-hmm. You had fun.
It was great.
Mm-hmm.
But there was like a definite like adjustment period, because my mom was like, all right, we're going to go down to the lake like after breakfast the first day. And she packed like a cooler of snacks. And when she says we're going to go down to the lake, it's in her backyard. So we have to go down like 75 steps that she's just had built down mm-hmm. to the lake. And so like me and my kids and my husband, we did like the requisite like hour swimming. And we were like, the lake, we've done the lake. Let's go back up to the house, you know, let's shower. Mm-hmm. And no one's following us. Like, my mom's still down there. My stepdad and the other cousins are down there.
They're just laking.
They're laking. They're just like, and I'm like, okay, well, they'll probably be up soon. I fed my, you know, kids lunch, and I got totally dressed and clean, and they're still down at the lake. And I was like, what the hell? So I went back down to the lake, got everyone in their swimsuit back down to the lake. We stayed at the lake for 8 hours, swimming on and off, kayaking. They would like play on the shore. And like on the first day, I was like, seemed excessive. But then after that, I was a lake person after that. I was like, we're going down to the lake and we ain't coming back till dinner time. Like,
God, did the kids just knock out? Did they completely just sleep?
They
did.
They were, yeah. And, you know, they got to stay up past their bedtime. You know, like, they just got to eat. My mom, who was never like this when I was a kid, has like all the junk food and juice and everything you could possibly want.
Hell
the
yeah.
kids just like ate whatever.
Oreos?
She did have Oreos. They didn't go for those. She had like those Fruit Loop cereal bars with the frosting on them.
Mm-hmm.
She had Capri Sun. She was like letting them have soda. Like, my kids didn't want soda because they don't like the fizziness, but like the other cousins were down in sodas. She had ice cream. Her and my stepdad made donuts and let the kids frost them and decorate them.
Whoa.
Yeah. It was like a total, like, Towns, ever since we got back, has been weeping because he wants to go back. And I'm like, you're fine. You have a great life. Okay. Your life's not that bad.
Oh my God.
But yeah, lake life. It was great.
That's awesome.
It was, yeah. We were supposed to stay with my mom half the time and my dad half the time. And my dad called me the day before we were supposed to go to his house. And he was like, well, I just tested positive for COVID. So I was like,
sorry, well, I don't know why I'd laugh. No. I immediately just start fucking laughing.
Because that's where we are in our lives.
Oh, God. Oh, Jesus Christ.
Anyway, so we stayed at my mom's the whole time and it was wonderful.
That's awesome.
Yeah. What about
we've been doing we're like in full summer mode, and I have Saturdays off now, which is crazy. I haven't had Saturdays off in this legitimately 10 years. I'm not making that up. And so my older daughter has, like, you know, she's doing golf lessons, she's doing t-ball, she's doing ballet, she's doing all this stuff. So Saturdays are like packed in with stuff for her. And then yeah, that's been great. It's been
life. That's life. Yeah, that's salad days.
Yeah. It's been totally different to have like so much time together as a family. It's been amazing. I mean, because even though my wife works from home, she is working. I mean, she's downstairs doing her thing. And then, course, you know, yeah. I'll make lunch. She'll come up. I'll make dinner. She'll come up. And I mean, a lot of times after we get the girls to bed, she's still working. So yeah. So Saturdays are really fun. And then I'm working Sunday mornings, and then I'm done at 1. So I still have a ton of my Sundays too, which is really great. So it's been great. It's been a really fun period. We had a friend visit. My friend Willie came and visited, which was really great. It was so awesome to see him. So he was goofing around with the girls, and they've just been asking for Willie nonstop now. Like, where's Willie? Cause I think this is crazy, but I think he's the first just like buddy I've had at the house because of work and Britt's work and the pandemic. And yeah, so they're not used to having like my friends over. So like when we told them, it was like, oh, this is daddy's friends coming over. They were like, what? Oh my God. Who friends? Like, who? I mean, I don't believe it, but I guess if he's going to be here. So yeah, it was fun. They had a blast.
Yeah. I get so stressed when people want to come over.
Oh yeah.
Because like, this is a home where 3 children live. So it's not, you know, like they trashed my mom's house. My mom has a brand new house that they built.
Oh, wow. Like,
glass railings on her staircase. She has an elevator in her house because her parents live there.
Damn. And
my kids, like every surface has been smudged, you know, licked. So I was like, bye.
Okay, bye.
So that's what my house looks like. And so whenever people are like, yeah, we should hang out, we should do a play date, I'm like, not over here.
Thanks for the donuts. Bye.
Yeah. But yeah, that's awesome. That sounds like an auspicious start to the summer.
Yeah, it's been good for sure. Other than that, my team is in the Stanley Cup Finals. It's consuming all my thoughts. They got absolutely spanked last night. So tomorrow's going to matter.
That's okay. They're going to play with rage tomorrow.
That is right, Lindsay. They are. And I know. So yeah, that'll be okay, hopefully. And yeah, that's kind of where I'm at. Yeah.
That's great. I started Justin Taylor's memoir.
Oh, I love it. Ghost. It's so good. It's
incredible.
I think it's my favorite book that I read 2 years ago when I read it. Did I read it 2 years ago?
Yeah, it came out in 2020.
Yeah.
Love to talk to him about that as well.
Yes. Oh my God. And he just sold a new novel.
Yeah, he did.
So yeah, we can talk about that. And I think that is going to be his first fiction in like over 10 years. Wow. I think his last story collection came out a long time ago. So he's going to be a really interesting person to talk about. Cause that's, yeah. Jesus.
That's a trajectory. All right.
Totally. Just someone who's completely in it. So that's awesome.
Yep.
Cool. Well, I'll talk to you in 4 days.
Okay. Bye.
Bye, bud.
I'm a Writer But is recorded by Alex Higley and me, Lindsay Hunter, in our respective basements. Editing by Lindsay Hunter. Music by Max Loop. Andrew, thank you again.
Yeah, this was a ton of fun. I love the show, and I can't wait for the episode to be up.
Oh, awesome. Thank you. Yeah, it's gonna come out. Listen, my kids are not in school.
How old are your kids?
9, 6, and 3. Or oh my God, 9, 6, and 4.
Wow, I can't even imagine.
I have kids.
I have one. So my son is a little more than a year old.
Oh, awesome.
He's
awesome.
A peanut.
He's a peanut, but I really can't. I mean, he's a lot of work. I mean, I think you get used to it more, but.
Oh, when we had our first, we were like, never again will we have a child. Holy shit. How do people do this? And then when he was three, we had our second.
The jump then, from one to two kicked my ass. I don't know how, how you do three. Three sounds, I mean, three sounds overwhelming, but. Yeah,
I mean, it's hard, but it really is. Going from one to two was way harder on us than going from two to three. Like, I had my kids out and about in my infant in the, yeah. So if you're dreaming of a bigger family, it's doable. It's great. It's totally great. It's mostly great with all the requisite, like, why do they scream so much? Why can't I pee with the door closed? Stop looking at me.
You know? Why are you reaching into the toilet all
day? Yeah, right.
Why do you live in the toilet? I don't know.
I don't want to hear mom 75,000 times a day.
I just saw a college friend who just had her third and her fourth as twins.
Oh my God.
No.
And they seem to be like losing it, but like somehow totally effortless.
That's amazing.
Jesus, I remember Christ. When Judith, my youngest, was probably like 4 weeks, we had gone to a neighbor's birthday party that day, and I had made the mistake of eating the buffet mac and cheese. I have a hard and fast rule. My husband first made up this rule, and now I ascribe to it myself. Don't eat the party food at the birthday parties. Just don't. I don't care if it's prepackaged Doritos. Something bad will happen. It always. So anyway, I made the mistake of eating that because I probably hadn't eaten and I was nursing. And that night I was, at that time when she was that little, I was sleeping in the same room as her. So at least one of us would be well rested for the other kids. And I was like, oh, okay. I'm going to shit my pants and throw up, and I'm nursing her. So I had to hold her and nurse her, throw up into her diaper pail, run into the bathroom and empty myself out on the toilet, still nursing her and trying not to wake anyone else up. And I remember thinking, like, first of all, like, congratulations to me for pulling this off. Like, I was ill. That's over now. She's fine. She's still nursing. I can put her to bed and I can lay down. But also, holy shit, I need therapy. Like, this shouldn't be real. This is terrible.
It was like a Lucian Freud painting.
Right?
Exactly. Exactly. Just like,
I can almost imagine it, like, in a very... in his style.
Yeah, definitely. Like, wow, what beautiful brush strokes. Look at the lighting. Oh my God, that's a horror movie that I'm staring at. That poor woman.
Oh, that poor woman.
Anyway, on that note, thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.
See ya.
Bye.